Chapter 3. We went back to the house and to work. Avera didn't hold class that day. Sallow and I did our sweeping. When we were sweeping the silkroom court, she came and took hold of my hand suddenly. She was in tears. She said, "Oh, Gav, I keep thinking about Oko. If I lost my little brother, I would die." She hugged me fiercely. And then, seeing I was crying too, she hugged me again, whispering, "You won't ever go away, will you, Gav?" I said, "Never. I promise." "I hear," she said, trying to smile. We both knew well enough what a slave's promise is worth. But still, it comforted us both. When we finished sweeping, she went with Reese to the spinning room. I went to the pantry and found Tib, and we loitered out to the back court. Some of the big boys were there. I held back. I had never been sure which ones had helped Hobie dunk me, but they spoke to us mildly. They were playing toss, and one of them lobbed the ball to me. I only had one hand to catch with, but caught and passed it creditably, and then stood back and watched them throw and catch. One of them asked, "Where's Hobie?" And another, Tan, said, "In trouble." "What for?" "Sucking up," Tan said, with a high loft of the ball to Tib. Tib fumbled it. Another boy retrieved it and lobbed it back to Tan. He caught it, tossed it high, and caught it, and turned to me. Tan was a stable boy, 16 or 17 years old, a short, thin fellow, almost as dark-skinned as me. "You had the right idea, young Gav," he said. "Stick to your own. Don't go looking for gratitude up there." He glanced at the windowed wall of Archimonde, towering over the courtyard and back at me, and winked. He had a keen, bright face. I'd always liked Tan, and was flattered by his notice. As the older boys left, another of them slapped me lightly on the shoulder, the kind of comradely notice that looks like nothing and means a lot. It brought a warmth to me I needed. I'd been down at the river in my head all morning, in the gray rain and the silence and the cold. Tib ran off to the kitchen to his work. I had nothing to do. I went to the schoolroom because there was nowhere else to go, and because if any room in Archimonde was my room, it was that one. It was dear to me, with its four high north windows, its carved and grimy benches and desks and tables, the teacher's lectern, the bookshelves and stacked-up copybooks and slates, the big glass ink jug from which we filled our inkwells. Sallow and I were in charge of keeping it swept, dusted, and orderly, and though it looked quite neat and peaceful, I set to sorting and straightening out the books on the long shelves. All work was made awkward by the splint on my finger. Often I stopped and had a look into a book I hadn't read yet. Sitting on the floor by the shelves, I opened Saltoke Asper's History of the City-State of Trebs, and got to reading about the long war between Hill Trebs and Carvol, which ended in the rebellion of the slaves in Hill Trebs and the utter destruction of the city. It was an exciting story, and troubling, because it was about what I had glimpsed through those cracks in the walls. I was completely lost in it when Avera said, "Gavir?" I leapt up and reverenced him and apologized. He smiled. "What's the book?" I showed him. "Read it if you like," he said. "Though it might be better to read Asham first. Asper is political. Asham is above opinion." He went over to his lectern and looked through some papers, then sat on the long-legged stool and looked at me again. I was rearranging books. "This is a heavy day," he said. I nodded. "I attended on Father Altandi this morning. I have some news that may lighten the day for you a little." He rubbed his hand over his mouth and jaw. "The family will be going to the country early this year, at the beginning of May. I will go with them, and all my pupils, except for Hobie. He is henceforth excused from school, and will serve under Hoster. And Tondi has been granted leave to stay in the city, and learn swordsmanship from a master teacher. He will join us in the country only at the end of the summer." This was a lot of news to absorb all at once, and at first I saw only the promise of a long country summer at the farm in the Ventine Hills. Then I saw the bonus. Without Hobie. Without Torm. That was a moment of bliss. It was quite a while before I began to think about it in any other terms. Tan and the other boys had already known it. This morning in the courtyard, news always got all over the house immediately. Hobie's in trouble for sucking up. Hobie hadn't been rewarded for his loyalty to Torm, but punished for it. Serving under Hoster meant being sent to the civic workforce, to which every house contributed a quota of male slaves to do the heaviest, hardest kind of labor and live in the city barrack, which was little better than a jail. On the other hand, Torm hadn't been punished for killing little Miv, but rewarded for it. Studying the arts of war was the dream of his heart. It burst out of me. "It's not fair." "Gavir," the teacher said. "But it's not, Teacher D. Torm killed Miv." "He didn't mean to, Gavir. Yet he's being made to do penance. He's not allowed to come with the mother and the rest of us to Vente. He will live with his teacher and be subjected to a very severe discipline. Swordmaster Atek's pupils lead a hard, bare life of constant training, with no reward for their increase of skill. The father spoke of it to Tormdi while I was there. He said, 'You must learn self-restraint, my son. And with Atek, you will learn it.' And Tormdi bowed his head. But then Hobie, what did he do to be punished?" The teacher was taken aback. "What did he do?" he repeated, looking at my scabs and swellings and splinted finger. "But that didn't hurt the family," I said, not knowing how to say what I felt. I meant that if Hobie was punished for what he'd done to me, it should be by his and my people, the slaves. That's why I hadn't said who hurt me. It was between us. It was beneath the family's notice. But if Hobie was being punished for his attempt to defend Torm, clumsy as it had been, then it was so unfair that it must be a mistake, a misunderstanding. "What happened to you was no accident," Avera said. "Though in your loyalty to your schoolmate you say it was. But Hobie was insolent to me. And through me the authority of the father acts in this classroom. That cannot be tolerated, Gavir. Listen now. Come sit here." He went to sit at the reading table, and I went to sit by him, as I would when reading with him. "Loyalty is a great thing, but loyalty misplaced is troublesome and dangerous. I know you're troubled. Everyone in the house is troubled. The death of a child is a pitiable thing. You're hearing wild, angry talk, maybe, in the barrack and the dormitory. When you hear such talk, you must think what this household is. Is it a wilderness? Is it a battlefield? Is it an endless, hidden war of sullen rage against implacable force? Is that the truth of your life here? Or have you lived here as a member of a family blessed by its ancestors, where each person has his part to play, always striving to act with justice? He let me think that over a minute, and went on. When in doubt, Gavir, look up, not down. Look up for guidance. Strength comes from above. Your part is with the highest in this house. Born wild as you were, a slave as you are, as I am, without family, yet you've been taken into the heart of a great household and given all you need, shelter and food, great ancestors and a kindly father to guide you. And as well as all that, nourishment for your spirit, the learning I was given and can pass on to you. You have been given trust, the sacred gift. Our family trusts us, Gavir. They entrust their sons and daughters to me. How can I earn that honor? By my loyal effort to deserve it. I wish, when I die, it might be said of me, he never betrayed those who trusted him. His dry voice had become gentle, and he looked at me a while before he went on. You know, Gavir, behind you, in the wilderness you came from, there's nothing for you. In the shifting sands beneath you, there's nothing for you to build on, but look up, above you, in the power that sustains you and the wisdom offered to you. There you can set your heart, there you can put your trust. There you will find treasure and justice and a mother's mercy, which you never knew. It was as if he talked of the house I had dreamed of, that sunlit house where I was safe and welcome and free. He restored it to me in waking life. I couldn't say anything, of course. He saw what comfort he had given me, though, and he reached out to pat my shoulder, as the boy in the courtyard had, a light, brotherly touch. He stood up to break the mood. What shall we take to read in the summer? He asked. And I said, without thinking, not Trudeck. The family had stayed in the city for the past 2 summers, since the farm had not been considered safe from roving bands of Otuzan soldiers out for plunder in the Ventine Hills. But our army had a camp now near Vente and had driven the Votuzans back to their city gates. I remembered the farm as a marvelous place. It was as if I felt the warmth of summer whenever I thought about it. Even the preparations for going were exciting, and when we actually set off, a great straggling procession of horse-drawn chariots and wagons and donkey carts and outriders and people afoot going through the streets of Etra to the river gate, it was as good as a hero's parade, even if we didn't have drums and trumpets. The chariots in which the women and girls and old people of the family rode were high and ungainly and seemed too wide for the bridge across the Nisus. But Sem and Tan and all the drivers and outriders were in their glory, guiding the teams across, hoofs clattering on the bridge, plumes on the harnesses nodding. Sotor's elder brothers rode ahead with Yavin on fine saddle horses. The wagons and carts came creaking behind, with a lot of shouting and whip-cracking, and the inevitable donkey, who didn't want to cross the bridge. Some of the women and little children rode on the wagons, high on the piled-up goods and foodstuff, but most of us walked. And when people stopped to watch us go by, Tib and I waved at them with patronizing pity, because we were going to the country, and they, poor cockroaches, had to stay all summer in the city. Tib and I were like dogs on an outing, traveling three times farther than anybody else because we kept running up the line of the procession and back to the back again. By noon, we had become a bit less energetic and mostly stayed close to the women's wagon, where Sallow and Reese had to ride, because they were getting to the age where girls can't run loose. They had Oko with them and several babies, and the kitchen women, who were always good for a handout of food when Tib and I came panting by. The road was going up now, winding among small hillside fields and oak groves. Ahead were the round green summits of the Ventine Hills. As we climbed, we began to be able to look back over the countryside and see the silver curve of the Nisos, where it ran down to the wider River Moor. Across the Nisos was Etra, our city, a hazy huddle of roofs, of thatch and wood and red tile in the circle of its walls, with four towered gates of yellowish stone. There was the bulk of the Senate House and the dome of the Forefathers' Shrine. We tried to make out the roofs of Archimonde, and were sure we saw the tops of the sycamore grove by the wall where we used to drill with Torm, miles away, years ago. The wagons creaked slower and slower. The horses strained at the climb. The drivers flicked their whips. The gaudy tops of the chariots up ahead dipped and rocked as the high wheels lurched in the ruts of the dusty road. The sun was hot. The breeze in the shade of the roadside oaks, cool. Cattle and goats in the wood-fenced pastures watched our procession solemnly. Colts at a horse farm went bucking off stiff-legged at the sight of the chariots and then came mincing back to have another look. Somebody came running down the line of carts and wagons, a girl, Sotor, who had escaped from the family and now clambered up onto the wagon to sit with Reese and Sallow. She was flushed with the excitement of her escapade and much more talkative than usual.
"I told Mother Falamar Io I wanted to ride outside, so she said go ahead, so I came back here. It's all stuffy and jouncy in the chariots, and Radili's baby threw up. It's much better here."
Pretty soon she began to sing, raising her sweet, strong voice in one of the old rounds everybody knew. Sallow and Reese joined in, and the kitchen women, and then people walking or riding in other wagons up the line sang too. So the music carried us up the road into the hills of Vente. We came to the Arca farm after sunset, a long day's journey of 10 miles. To look back on that summer and the summers after, it's like looking across the sea to an island, remote and golden over the water, hardly believing that one lived there once. Yet, it's still here within me, sweet and intense. The smell of dry hay, the endless shrill chant of crickets on the hills, the taste of a ripe, sun-warmed stolen apricot, the weight of a rough stone in my hands, the track of a falling star through the great summer constellations. All the young people slept outdoors, ate together, played together. Yavin, Astano, and Sotor and the cousins from Haramond, and Sallow and I, Tib and Reese, and Oko. The cousins were a skinny boy and girl of 13 and 10, Uter and Umo. They had been unwell, and their mother, Sotor's elder sister, brought them to the farm hoping the country air would be good for them. There was a whole scrabble of little kids, too. Family babies, Sotor's nieces and nephews, and slave children being mothered. But the women looked after them, and we had little to do with them. We, big ones, had lessons with Avera early in the morning, and then were set free for the rest of the long, hot day. There was no work for us. The slave women from the city waited on the family and looked after the huge old farmhouse along with its regular housekeepers, of whom there were plenty. Tib had been brought as a kitchen boy, but was so unneeded that he was released to study and play with us. Everything else on the farm was in the hands of its people. They lived in a fair-sized village, down the hill from the great house, in an oak grove by a stream, and did whatever it was farm people did. We city children knew nothing of them, and were ordered to keep out of their way. That was easy. We were busy with our own doings from morning till night, exploring the hills and forests, wading and splashing in the shallow streams, building dams, raiding orchards, making willow whistles and daisy chains and tree houses, doing everything, doing nothing, whistling and singing and chattering like a flock of starlings. Yavin spent some time with the grown-ups, but much more with us, leading us on expeditions up into the hills, or organizing us to put on a play or dance to entertain the family. Avera would write us out a little mask or drama. Astano, Rhys, and Salo had been trained in dance, and with Sotor's pure, true voice to lead the singing, and Yavin playing the lyre, we put on some pretty shows. Using the big threshing floor as our stage, and the hay barn as our backstage. Tib and I were sometimes the comic relief, and sometimes the army. I loved the rehearsals, and the costumes, and the tension and thrill of those evenings. All of us did. And as soon as we'd put on a show and been politely applauded by our noble audience, we started discussing the next one, and begging Teacher D for a subject. But the best times of all were the nights after the hot days of midsummer, when it finally began to cool off, and a little wind stirred from the west, though heat lightning still played in the dark sky to the south, and we lay on our straw-stuffed mattresses out under the stars and talked, and talked, and talked. And one by one fell silent, fell asleep. If eternity had a season, it would be midsummer. Autumn, winter, spring are all change and passage, but at the height of summer, the year stands poised. It's only a passing moment, but even as it passes, the heart knows it cannot change. Good as my memory is, I'm not always sure what happened in which summer of those three we spent at Vente, because they seem all one long golden day and starlit night. I do remember from the first summer how pleasant it was not to have Torm and Hobie with us. Salo and I spoke of it to each other with surprise, having scarcely known how Hobie's hostility oppressed us or how much we feared Torm's outbreaks. Miv's death, though we seldom spoke of it, had made our dread of Torm urgent and immediate. It was wonderful to be completely away from him. Astano and Yavin seemed to be relieved and released by his absence as much as we were. They were older, they were family, but here they played with us without observance of age or class. It was the last summer of Yavin's boyhood, and he enjoyed it as a boy, active, high-spirited, careless of his dignity, joyful in his strength. With him and us, and away from the restraint of the women of the family, his sister Astano, too, became merry and bold. It was Astano who first led us on a fruit raid in our neighbor's orchards. Oh, They'll never miss a few apricots, she said, and showed us the shortcut to the back of the orchard where the pickers hadn't come yet and wouldn't notice us. Although they did, of course, and taking us for common thieves, came shouting and hurling rocks and clods at us with deadlier intent than ever Tib and I had when we were being Votusans. We fled. When we got onto our own land, Yavin, panting and laughing, recited from the bridge on the Nisos. Then fled the Morvan soldiers, the men of Morva ran. Like sheep before the ravening wolf, they fled the Etra van. Those men are horrible, Rhys said. She'd barely gotten away from a big fellow who chased her to the borderline and threw a rock after her, which luckily just grazed her arm. Brutes? Sallow was comforting little Oko, who had been following us into the orchard when we all came flying past her in a shower of rocks and clods. Oko was scared, but soon reassured by our laughter and Yavin's posturing. Yavin was always aware of the younger children's fears and feelings, and was particularly gentle with Oko. He picked her up to ride on his shoulder, while he declaimed, "Are we then men of Morva, to flee before the foe? Or shall we fight for Etra, like our fathers long ago?" "They're just mean," Astano declared. "The apricots are falling off the trees. They'll never get them all picked." "We're actually helping them pick," said Sotor. "Exactly. They're just mean and stupid. I suppose we could go ask Senator Obey if we could pick some fruit in his orchard," said Uther, one of the skinny cousins from Haramond, a very law-abiding kind of boy. "It tastes a lot better when you don't ask," Yavin said. I was inspired by memories of our skirmishes and sieges in the sycamore grove, which I still missed, despite their wretched outcome. I said, "They're Morvans. Cowardly, brutal, selfish Morvans. Are we of Etra to endure their insults?" "Certainly not," said Yavin. "We are to eat their apricots." "When do they stop picking?" Sotor asked. "Evening," somebody said. Nobody really knew. We paid no attention to the activities of the farm workers, which went on around us like the doings of the bees and ants and birds and mice, the business of another species. Sotor was for coming back at night and helping ourselves freely to apricots. Tib thought they left dogs in the Obey orchards to guard them at night. Yavin, taken by my warlike stance, suggested that we plan a raid on the orchards of Morva, but properly conducted this time, with reconnoitering beforehand and lookouts posted, and perhaps some ammunition stockpiled with which to respond to enemy missiles and defend our retreat if necessary. So began the great war between Etrin Arca and Morvan Obey, which went on in one orchard or another for a month. The farm workers on the Obey estate soon were keenly aware of us and our depredations, and if we posted lookouts, so did they. But our time was free. We could choose when to strike, while they were bound to their work, to pick the fruit and sort and carry it away, all under the overseer's eye and his lash, if they were slow or lazy. We were like birds, flitting in and stealing and flitting off again. We thought nothing of their anger, their hatred of us, and taunted them mercilessly when we'd made a particularly good haul. They'd learned that we weren't all slave children, as they'd thought at first, and that tied their hands. If a slave threw a rock and hit a young member of the Arca family, the whole orchard crew might be in mortal trouble. So they had to hold their fire and try to intimidate us, merely by numbers and by setting their cur dogs on us. To make up for their disadvantage, we made a rule. If they saw us, we had to retreat. It wasn't fair, Astano said, to take fruit openly, under their noses, since they couldn't retaliate. We had to steal it while they were there in the orchard. This rule made it extremely dangerous and exciting, with only one or two tree robbers per expedition. But any number of watchers and warners to hoot, tweet, chirp, and whistle when the enemy came close. Then, if we'd made off with some plums or early pears, we could pop up on the home side of the boundary, display our loot, and exult in our victory. The Great Fruit Wars came to an end when Mother Falamare told Yavin that a little group of our farm slave children had been savagely beaten by a group of orchardists at Obey Farm who caught them stealing plums. One boy had had his eye gouged out. The mother said nothing to Yavin beyond telling him what had happened, but when he brought the report to the rest of us, he told us that we'd have to stop our raids. The farm children had probably hoped to be mistaken for us, and so get away unhurt, but the trick hadn't worked, and the men from Obey had taken their rage out against them. Yavin apologized to us formally for his thoughtlessness in leading us into doing harm, and Astano, repressing tears, joined him. "It was my fault," she said. "Not yours. None of you." They took full responsibility, as they would do when they were grown, when Yavin was the father of Archimond and Astano, perhaps, mother of another household, when every decision would be theirs and theirs alone. "I hate those awful orchard slaves," Rhys said. "The farm people really are brutes," Umo said regretfully. "Foul Morvans," Tib said. "We were all disconsolate. If we didn't have an enemy, we needed a cause." "I tell you what," Yavin said. "We could do the fall of Sentas." "Not with weapons," Astano said very softly and lightly. "No, of course not. I mean, like a play."
"How?"
"Well, first we'd have to build Sentas. I was thinking the other day that the top of the hill behind the East Vineyard, you know, it's like a citadel. There are all those big rocks up there. It would be easy to fortify it and make some trenches and earthworks. Teacher D has the book here. We could get the plans out of it. Then we could take different parts. You know, Oko could be General Thor, and Gav could say the envoy's speeches, and Sotor could be the prophetess Yurno. We wouldn't have to do the fighting parts, just the talking." It didn't sound very exciting, but we all trooped up to the hilltop, and as Yavin paced around among the big tumbled rocks and described where we could build a wall or make an earthwork, the idea of building a city began to take hold. Later in the afternoon, he got Avera to bring out the book and read us passages from the epic, and our imaginations caught fire from the grand words and tragic episodes. We all chose what characters we would be, and all of us were Sentons. Nobody wanted to be a besieging warrior from Pagadi, not even the great General Thor, or the hero Rurek, not even though Pagadi had won the war and destroyed the city, so that now, after hundreds of years, Sentas was still a poor little town among great ruined walls. Usually, we were on the side of the winners. But we were going to build doomed Sentas, and so her cause was ours, and we would fall with her. We built Sentas and enacted her glory and her fall all the rest of the summer. Building was hard work up there on the hilltop in the sparse, dry grass with the sun beating down and no shade, except under the rock walls and towers we piled up. The two little girls, Oko and Umo, toiled up and down the hill with water from the stream while the rest of us sweated and grunted. We swore with parched mouths when a stone refused to fit in its place or slipped and came down on a finger. We greeted the water carriers with praise and rejoicing. Astano's delicate hands were rough and bruised, as hard, the mother said, as horse hoofs. But the mother smiled and didn't reprove. She even came out several times and walked up the hill of Centos to see how the work was going. Yavin and Astano showed her our triumphs of engineering, the Eastern Gate, the Tower of the Ancients, the defensive ramparts. Erect in her light summer robes, smooth-faced, smiling, she listened, nodded, approved. I saw her hand sometimes laid lightly, almost timidly, on her tall son's arm, and saw the yearning in the gesture, though I didn't understand it. I think she was happy in our happiness, and, like us, wanted it unshadowed by any thought of days past or days to come. Evera also came up the hill frequently to oversee the plans and layout of the buildings and defenses according to the chart in his copy of the book, and we'd persuade him to stay and read to us from the epic while we took a break from rock-laying and ditch-digging. It was, he said, a most excellent educational opportunity from which we would all profit. He was so enthusiastic about it that he might have been a real nuisance, demanding pedantic improvements and corrections to our architecture. But he'd begin to wilt in the heat by mid-morning and go back down, leaving us on the windy, white-hot hilltop, building up our stones and our dreams. All these months, the great farmhouse had been a household of women and children. The father stayed in Etra because the Senate was meeting almost daily. Sotor's older brother, Soter, rode out to Vente every now and then to spend a night or two with his wife and children. But the other brother, Sodera, a lawyer, was kept in town by what Sotor always called his suitcases. Great-uncle Yavin Hero Arca, in his 90s, had been brought along to sit out under the oak trees. Most of the time, our Yavin was the man of the house, though he chose not to play the role. Among the farmhouse staff were a few old handymen, past much real work, but most of the house people were women. They were used to running things with no masters present, and were more independent both in act and manner than the city house people. There was a lack of hierarchy and protocol. Everything seemed to go along quite well without the formalities and rigidities of life at Archimonde, the creaking and straining, the needless complications. When the mother wanted to make plum jam the way it had been made at Galecamonde, when she was a girl, there wasn't the bowing and scraping there might have been in the great kitchens of Archimonde, nor the suppressed resentment at the interruption. Old Akko, the chief cook of the farm, stood over the mother as she'd stand over apprentice, and was free with her criticisms. Babies were common property. Slave women cared for family babies, of course, but also the mother and Soter's and Sodera's wives looked after slave children, and all the tiny ones crawled and staggered about together and fell asleep in promiscuous heaps like kittens. We ate outside at long tables under the oak trees near the kitchen, and though there was a family table and a slave table, seating wasn't all by status. Evera usually sat at the family table at the invitation of the mother and Yavin, while Sotor and Astano, self-invited, sat with Rhys and Sallow at ours. We sorted ourselves out less by rank than by age and preference. This ease, this commonality, was a great part of the happiness of life at Vente. But it changed. It had to change. When the father arrived for the last few weeks of the summer, bringing both his nephews with him and Torm. The first evening of their arrival seemed to bode ill. The family table was full of men now. The family women and girls all sat there, dressed up, looking far more ladylike than they had all summer, in modest silence, while the men talked. Metter and the valets, who had ridden out with the men, sat with us and talked with one another. Avera sat with us, silent. We children were frowned at, if we spoke. Dinner was served formally and went on a long time, and after it, the children of the family, Yavin and Astano, Sotor, Umo and Uter, all went indoors with the adults of the family. We five slave children, left outside, loitered about, disconsolate. It was too late to go down to Sentos. Salo suggested we walk down the road by the farm village to see if the blackberries in the hedges were ripening. Some of the children there saw us, and hiding behind the brambly hedges, they threw stones at us. Not big stones, not to kill, only pebbles. But maybe they had slingshots, for a hit stung like fury, and left a small black bruise. Poor little Oko, the first to be hit, shrieked out that there was a hornet. Then we all began to get stung. We saw the missiles flying over the hedge and got a glimpse of our assailants. One, a big boy, leapt up and jeered something in his uncouth dialect. We ran, not laughing as we had run from the orcharders, but in real fear. We saw the twilight darkening around us and felt hatred at our backs. When we got back to the farm, Oko and Reese were both crying. Salo quieted Oko down. We bathed our bruises and sat on our hay-filled mattresses as the stars came out and talked. Salo said, "They saw there weren't any family children with us." "But what do they hate us for?" Oko mourned. Nobody said anything. "Maybe because we can do a lot of things they can't," I said. "And their fathers hate us," said Salo, "for the fruit wars."
"I hate them," Reese said.
"I do too," said Oko.
"Dirty peasants," Tib said, and I felt the same fierce contempt, and along with it the faint, sweet self-disgust of conscious prejudice, of despising what you're afraid of. We were silent for a long time, watching the stars come out above the black crowns of the oaks and the roofs of the house.
"Salo," Oko whispered, "is he going to sleep with us?"
She meant Torm. Oko was utterly terrified of Torm. She had seen him kill her brother. By sleep with us, she meant would he come out, as the family children had been doing all summer, to sleep as we did on hay mattresses under the stars.
"I don't think so, Oko sweet," Salo said in her soft voice. "I don't think any of them will, tonight. They have to stay in and be gentlefolk." But waking before dawn, when the constellations of winter were fading in the brightening eastern sky, I saw Astano and Sotor get up from their mattresses, wrapping their light blankets around them, and steal barefoot back to the house. The family children came out of the house much later than usual that morning. We hadn't decided whether we should go down to Sentos Hill without them, and were still discussing it when we saw them. Yavin called out, "Come on, what are you all sitting around here for?" Torm wasn't with them. The girls were in their country clothes, like us, tunics over trousers, ragged and dusty. We joined the group. Yavin picked up Oko and put her on his shoulders. "Brave charioteer," he said, "drive your fiery steed to the high walls and gates of Sentos. Onward!" Oko gave a little squeak of a war cry, and Yavin galloped off down the path, neighing.
We all galloped after him. The phrase, a born leader, is a common one. I suppose many men are leaders by nature. There are a lot of ways to lead, a lot of goals to lead to. The first true leader I knew was this boy of 17, Yaven Altanter Arca, and I have judged others by him. By that standard, leadership means personal magnetism, active intelligence, unquestioning acceptance of responsibility, and something harder to define, a tension between justice and compassion, which is never satisfied by one without the other, and so can seldom be wholly satisfied. At this moment, Yaven was divided between his allegiance to all of us Sentons and the protective loyalty he felt he owed to his younger brother. Along towards noon, when it was time to send a volunteer to fetch bread and cheese and whatever else the kitchen had for us for lunch, he said, "I'll go." He came back with the lunch sack and with Torm. As soon as she saw Torm climbing the hill, Oko shrank into the maze of rocks behind the Tower of the Ancients. Presently, Sallow slipped away with her, down to the stream that ran by the foot of our hill. Yaven showed Torm all over our rock buildings and earthworks, explaining how they followed the historic plans, and telling him of the scenes that would be enacted when we'd finished building Sentos and were ready for the siege and fall. Torm followed him about, saying little, looking stiff and uncomfortable. But he did say some words of praise for the circumvallation, our masterpiece. Our rock buildings were small and shaky, and required the eye of love to see much resemblance to towers and gates in them. But our earthworks were, on their small scale, perfectly real. We had built a palisade right around the summit of the hill, with a steep-sided ditch, the circumvallation, outside it, piling up the earth against the inner side of the palisade to brace it and give foothold to the defenders. You really couldn't get into Sentos except by a long, single-plank bridge across the ditch and through the single gate in the palisade. Torm still didn't say much, but he was clearly impressed by the size and extent of our labors. "Here," Yaven said, "I'll lead a surprise assault. Men of Sentos, to the walls, to the gate. The enemy comes. Defend our homes." He went off down the hill a bit while we closed the gate and ran its big wooden bolt into the socket and swarmed up onto the slanting earth inside the palisade or atop the wobbly rock walls of the inner citadel. Then Yaven came charging up the hill and across the plank, and we all yelled defiance and rained down invisible arrows and spears upon him. He rattled the gate mightily and then sank down and died in front of it, while we cheered. Torm watched it all. Not part of our game, but clearly drawn to it by its nature and by our excitement. We opened the gate and welcomed Yaven in and sat down in whatever shade we could find to eat lunch. Sotor slipped off with some food for Sallow and Oko down at the creek. "So, what do you think of Sentos?" Yaven asked. Torm said, "It's fine. Very good." His voice had deepened. He sounded like the father. "Only it's sort of foolish. People going boang." He imitated the way we pretended with empty hands to draw a bow and shoot. "I suppose it does look silly. You've been using real weapons all summer," Yaven said with his easy, honest courtesy. Torm nodded, condescending. "This is just play. A play." "It did get us out of lessons, though," said Yaven, and this was true. Avera had given up any pretense of holding class once the building of Sentos had got underway. He assured the mother and himself that it had actually been his idea. A means of teaching us the epic poem, the history of the war between Pagadi and Sentas, and the architecture of defense.
If you didn't use the others, you could have swords and bows, Torm said. There'd be six of us.
They'd still be toy weapons, Yavin said after the slightest pause.
Not like what you've been learning.
Oh, I wouldn't give Sotor a sword with an edge. She'd have my liver out before I knew it.
But you couldn't give slaves weapons, Uther said, not having understood what Torm meant by the others.
Uther was always coming out with rules and prohibitions and moralisms. Sotor called him Trudek.
It's against the law.
Torm went black-browed. He said nothing. I glanced at Tib, who was cringing like me at the memory of our punishment for playing soldiers for Torm. And I saw Yavin glance over at his sister, Astano.
Get us out of this, his glance said.
And she did, promptly, speaking fluently and almost at random, as women are trained to do.
I'd hate to have even toy weapons, she said. I like our air bows and arrows. I never miss with them. And they don't hurt anybody. Anyhow, we're ages from any battles yet, aren't we? We'd have to do all the envoy's speeches first. The ditch took so long. We haven't got the tower really steady yet, but the rocks are real enough, Torm. You'll see, when you've carried them around and piled them up all day, even the little ones helped build, Umo and Oko. We're all Sentons.
So she fought, with what weapons she had been given, to defend the city we had built together all that summer. Our city of sunlit air. Torm shrugged. He finished chewing his bread and cheese in silence. He went down to the stream for a drink. We saw Salo, Oko, and Sotor shrink back, hiding from him among the tall grasses of the bank. He paid them no attention. He waved up at Yavin, shouted something, and set off alone back to the house on the white path by the vineyard, a sturdy, solitary figure, swinging his arms. We went back to building for a while, but a shadow had fallen across our make-believe. And though during what was left of the summer we all went down to work on Sentas almost daily, it was never quite the same. The family children were called away often, Yavin and Torm and Uther to go on hunting parties with the father and neighboring landowners, the girls to entertain the landowners' wives. Sotor and Umo, who passionately loved our dream game, escaped these duties and joined us whenever they could. But Astano couldn't escape. And without her and Yavin, we lacked direction. We lacked conviction. But all the delights of Vente were still there, swimming and wading in the streams, figs coming ripe, which we didn't need to steal because the fig trees were right behind the great house, talking together before we slept out under the stars. And we had one great final day of happiness. Astano proposed that we walk all the way up to the summit of the Ventine Hills. It was farther than we could go and return in a day, so we took food and water and blankets. One of the farm boys followed us with the baggage loaded on a jenny. We set off very early. There was a chill in the air now before the sun rose, a foretaste of autumn. The dry grass on the hills was burnt pale gold. The shadows were longer than they had been. We climbed and climbed on an old track, a shepherd's path that wound among the great round hills. The scattered flocks of mountain sheep had no fear of us, but stared and challenged us with their harsh bleating, almost like roaring. There were no fences up here, since mountain sheep keep to their own pastures without fences or shepherds. But among the flocks were big gray dogs, wolf guards. These dogs ignored us as we passed by, but if we stopped, a dog would begin to walk forward toward us. silent, very clearly saying, "Now you just move along and everything will be fine." And we moved along. Torm and Uther didn't come with us. They had chosen to go wolf hunting down in the pine forests with the uncles Soter and Sodera instead. Oko and Umo, who, though 10 years old, was not very much bigger than Oko at 6, stumped along valiantly. Yavin gave Oko a ride on his shoulders now and then, and during the last long, steep pull, in late afternoon, we took the food and blankets off the Jenny and put the 2 little girls up on her pack saddle. She was a pretty creature, gray as a mouse. I had no idea what a Jenny was. She looked like a small horse to me. Sotor explained that if her father had been a donkey and her mother a horse, she would have been a mule. But since her mother had been a donkey and her father a horse, she was a Jenny. The boy who had been leading her stood listening to this explanation with the dull, glowering expression the farm people seemed always to have. "That's right, isn't it, Komi?" Sotor asked him. He jerked his head and looked away, scowling. "It's all in who your ancestors are," Sotor said to the Jenny. "Isn't it, Mousy?" The boy Komi tugged at the halter, and Mousy walked along peaceably, Oko and Umo clinging to the saddle, scared and gleeful. We all trudged along with our light burdens, which we certainly could have carried all day, but we were glad to come up at last onto the very summit of the highest hill and stop climbing and stand gazing at the great view that lay all around us, miles and miles of sunlit land, pale gold fading into blue, the long shadows of August falling in the folds of the hills. There was Etra, remote and tiny in the vast sweep of the plains. We could see farmhouses and villages all along the courses of the streams and the river Moor, and far-sighted Yavin said he could make out the walls of Kasikar and a tower above them, though I could see only a kind of smudge there on the deep bend of the moor. East that way and southward, the land was hilly and broken, but to the north and west, it fell away and widened into immense, dim levels, green, fading into the blue distance. "That's the Danaran Forest," Yavin said, looking northeast. "That's the marshes," Astano said, looking north, and Sotor said, "Where you and Gav come from, Sallow?" Sallow stood beside me, and we looked that way for a long time. It gave me a strange, cold thrill to see that vastness, that unknown country where we had been born. All I knew of the people of the marshes was that they weren't city people. They were uncivilized, barbarians, natives. We had ancestors there, as free people did. We had been born free. It troubled me to think about that. It was a useless thought. What did it have to do with my life in Etra? With my family of Archimonde? "Do you remember the marshes at all?" Sotor asked us. Sallow shook her head, but I said, to my own surprise, "Sometimes I think I do." "What was it like?" I felt foolish describing that simple memory or vision aloud to them. "Just water, and reeds growing in the water, and little islands. And there was a blue hill away far off. Maybe it was this hill." "You were only a baby, Gav," Sallow said, with just a touch of cautioning in her voice. "I was 2 or 3, and I can't remember anything." "Not about being stolen?" Sotor asked, disappointed. "That would have been exciting." "I don't remember anything but Archimonde, Sotor Io," Sallow said in her soft voice, smiling. We spread our feast out on the thin, dry grass of the hilltop and ate it as the sun went down in glory, revealing the ocean to us by the gleam of the high horizon where it set. We sat and talked, in all the old ease and companionship of the long summer. The little ones fell asleep. Sallow fell asleep with her head on my lap. Reese brought me a blanket, and I tucked it round my sister as best I could. The stars were coming out. The boy, Comey, who had sat all evening at a distance between us and the picketed Jenny, facing away from us, began to sing. At first I didn't know what I was hearing. It was such a thin, strange, sad sound, like the vibrations in the air after a bell has been struck. It rose and trembled and died away. "Sing again, Comey," Sotor murmured. "Please." He was silent for so long we thought he wouldn't sing, but then the faint tremor of sound began again, the thinnest thread of music, the overtones of a tune. It was inexpressibly sad and yet serene, untroubled. Again it died away, and we listened for it, wanting it to return. It was utterly silent now, up on the wide hill, and the glimmer of starlight was stronger than the last blue-brown light far down in the west. The Jenny stamped and made a little huh-huh noise in her chest, and we laughed at that and talked a little more, softly. Then we slept.